Chapter 3. A Fan of Colors. Matt did not know whether to curse or weep. With the soldiers gone and Ebu Dar about to be left in his dust, there seemed no reason for the dice. But there never was a bloody reason he could see until it was too late. Whatever was coming might lie days in the future, or only an hour, but he had never been able to figure it out ahead of time. The only certainties were that something important, or dire, was going to happen, and that he would not be able to avoid it. Sometimes, like that night at the gate, he did not understand why the dice had been tumbling, even after they stopped. All he really knew for sure was that however much the dice made him twitch like a goat with the itch, once they started, he did not want them to stop ever. But they did. Sooner or later, they always did.
"Are you all right, Matt?" Ulver said. "Those Seanchan can't catch us."
He attempted gruff conviction, but a hint of question hung in his voice. Abruptly, Matt realized he had been staring at nothing. Aginin frowned at him while fiddling absent-mindedly with her wig, plainly angry that he was ignoring her. Doman's eyes had a studious look. If he was not deciding whether to be upset on Aginin's behalf, Matt would eat his cap. Even Thera was peeking at him past the tent's entry flap, and she always tried to keep out of Aginin's sight. He could not explain. Only a man with porridge for brains would believe he got warnings from hearing dice no one could see. Or maybe a man marked by the power. Or by the Dark One. He was not anxious to have any of those things suspected of him. And it might be that night at the gate all over again. No, this was not a secret he cared to reveal. It would do no good anyway.
"They'll never catch us, Ulver. Not you and me."
He ruffled the boy's hair, and Ulver gave a wide-mouthed grin, confidence restored as easy as that.
"Not so long as we keep our eyes open and our wits about us. Remember, you can find a way out of any difficulty if you keep your eyes and wits sharp. But if you don't, you'll trip over your own feet."
Ulver nodded gravely, but Matt meant the reminder for the others. Or maybe himself. Like there was no way any of them could be more alert. Except for Ulver, who thought it was all a great adventure, they had all been jumping out of their skins since before leaving the city.
"Go help Thera, like Julin told you, Ulver."
A sharp gust cut through Matt's coat, making him shiver. "And put your coat on. It's cold," he added as the boy ducked past Thera into the tent. Rustles and scraping sounds from inside said that Ulver was setting to work, with or without his coat, but Thera remained crouched at the tent's entrance, peering at Matt. For all the care anybody but Matt Cawthon took, the boy could catch his death. As soon as Ulver disappeared, Aginin stepped closer to Matt, her fists on her hips again, and he groaned under his breath.
"We are going to settle matters now, Cawthon," she said in a hard voice. "Now. I won't have our journey wrecked by you countermanding my orders."
"There's nothing to settle," he told her. "I was never your hired hand, and that's that." Somehow her face managed to grow harder, as good as shouting that she did not see matters like that. The woman was as tenacious as a snapping turtle, but there had to be some way to pry her jaws from his leg. Burn him if he wanted to be alone with the dice rolling in his head, yet that was better than having to listen to them while arguing with her. "I'm going to see Tuon before we leave." The words popped out of his mouth before they were clear in his head. He realized that they had been lying there for some time, though, murky and slowly solidifying. The blood drained from Aginin's cheeks as soon as Tuon's name left his mouth, and he heard a squeak from Thera followed by the snap of the tent flaps being jerked shut. The one-time Panarch had absorbed a great many Seanchan ways while she was Suroth's property, and many of their taboos as well. Aginin was made of harder stuff, however.
"Why?" she demanded.
In almost the same breath she went on, anxious and furious all at once.
"You mustn't call her that. You must show respect."
"Harder in some ways." Matt grinned, but she did not seem to see the joke. "Respect?" There was precious little respect in stuffing a gag in someone's mouth and rolling them up in a wall hanging. Calling Tuon High Lady or anything else was not going to change that. Of course, Aginin was more willing to talk about freeing Damani than she was about Tuon. If she could have pretended the kidnapping never happened, she would have, and as it was, she tried. Like she had tried to ignore it while it was happening. In her mind, any other crimes she might have committed paled to nothing beside that.
"Because I want to talk with her," he said.
And why not? He had to sooner or later. People had begun trotting up and down the narrow street now, half-dressed men with their shirts hanging out and women with their hair still wrapped in nightkerchiefs,
some leading horses and others just milling about as far as he could make out. A wiry boy a little bigger than Ulver went past doing handsprings wherever the crowd gave him a pace of room, practicing or maybe playing. The sleepy fellow in the deep green wagon still had not appeared. Luca's grand traveling show would not be traveling anywhere for hours yet. There was plenty of time.
"You could come with me," he suggested in his most innocent voice. He should have thought of this before.
The invitation made a Ginnungo fence post stiff for true. It hardly seemed possible her face could grow any paler, but an extra scrap of color leached out.
"You will show her fitting respect," she said hoarsely, clutching the knotted scarf with both hands as though trying to squeeze the black wig tighter onto her head. "Come, Bale. I want to make sure my things are stowed properly."
Doman hesitated as she turned and hurried away into the crowd without looking back, and Matt watched him warily. He had vague memories of a flight on Doman's river ship once, but vague was the best he could say of them. Tom was friendly with Doman, a point in the Ilioner's favor, yet he was a Geenan's man to the knife, ready to back her on anything down to disliking Julin, and Matt trusted him no further than he did her, which was to say not very far. Aginan and Doman had their own goals, and whether Matt Cawthon kept a whole hide did not factor in them. He doubted that the man really trusted him for that matter, but then neither of them had much choice at the moment.
"Fortune prick me," Doman muttered, scratching the bristles growing above his left ear. "Whatever you do be up to, you may be in over your head. I think she do be tougher than you do suspect."
"Aginan," Matt said incredulously.
He looked around quickly to see whether anyone in the alley had heard his slip. A few glanced at him and Doman as they brushed by, but nobody glanced twice. Luca was not the only one eager to be gone from a city where the flow of patrons for the show had dried up, and night lightning setting the harbor on fire was a fresh memory. They might all have fled that first night, leaving Matt nowhere to hide, except for Luca arguing them out of it. That promised gold made Luca very persuasive.
"I know she's tougher than old boots, Doman. But old boots don't count with me. This isn't a bloody ship, and I'm not letting her take charge and ruin everything."
Doman grimaced as if Matt were goose-brained.
"The girl, man. Do you believe you can be so calm if you did be carried off in the night? Whatever you be playing at with that wild talk of her being your wife, have a care or she may shave your head at the shoulders." "I was just cutting the fool," Matt muttered. "How many times do I have to say it? I was unnerved for a minute."
Oh, he had been that. Learning who Tuan was, while he was wrestling with her, would have unnerved a bloody trollic. Doman grunted in disbelief. Well, it was hardly the best story Matt had ever come up with. Except for Doman, everyone who had heard him babbling seemed to accept the tale, though. Matt thought they had, anyway. Aginan might get a knot in her tongue at the very thought of Tuan, but she would have said plenty if she believed he had been serious. Likely she would have put her knife in him. Peering in the direction Aginan had gone, the Ilioner shook his head.
"Try to keep a grip on your tongue from now on. Lylwyn, do near have a fit whenever she do think about what you did say. I've heard her muttering under her breath, and you can wager the girl herself does take it no lighter. You cut the fool with her, and you may get us all shortened."
He slid a finger across his throat expressively and gave a curt nod before pushing through the crowd after Aginan. Watching him go, Matt shook his own head. Tuan tough? True, she was the daughter of the Nine Moons and all of that, and she had been able to get under his skin with a look back in the Terrace and Palace when he thought she was just another Shan Chan noblewoman with her nose in the air, but that was just because she kept turning up where he did not expect. No more than that.
Tough?
She looked like a doll made of black porcelain.
How tough could she be?
It was all you could do to keep her from breaking your nose, and maybe more, he reminded himself. He had been careful not to repeat what Doman called wild talk, but the truth of it was he was going to marry Tuan. The thought made him sigh. He knew it as sure as prophecy, which it was, in a way. He could not imagine how such a marriage could come about. It seemed impossible on the face of it, and he would not weep if that proved to be so. But he knew it would not. Why did he always find himself bloody lumbered with bloody women who pulled knives on him or tried to kick his head off? It was not fair. He intended to go straight to the wagon where Tuon and Seleucia were being kept, with Setala Anand to watch. The innkeeper could make a stone seem soft. A pampered noblewoman and a lady's maid would give her no trouble, especially with a red arm on duty outside. At least they had not so far, or he would have heard. But he found his feet wandering, taking him along the winding streets that ran through the show. Bustle filled all of them, wide and narrow alike. Men rushed by leading horses that frisked and shied, too long without exercise. Other people were taking down tents and packing the storage wagons, or hauling cloth-wrapped bundles or brass-bound chests and casks and canisters of every size out of the house-like wagons that had been standing here for months, partially unloading so everything could be repacked for travel, even while the teams were being harnessed. The din was constant. Horses whickered, women shouted for children. Children cried over lost toys or yelled for the pure pleasure of noise. Men bellowed to know who had been at their harness or who had borrowed some tool. A troop of acrobats, slender but muscular women, who worked on ropes dangling from tall poles, had surrounded one of the horse handlers, all of them waving their arms and giving voice at the top of their lungs, and nobody listening. Matt paused a moment trying to figure out what they were arguing over, but eventually he decided they were not sure themselves. Two fighting coatless men rolled on the ground, watched closely by the likely cause, a willowy, hot-eyed seamstress named Jemen, but Petra appeared, and pulled them apart before Matt could even get a bet down. He was not afraid of seeing Tuon again. Of course not. He had stayed away after sticking her into that wagon to give her time to settle down and collect herself. That was all. Only calm, Doman had called her, and it was true. Kidnapped in the middle of the night, snatched out into a storm by people who would as soon have cut her throat as look at her, as far as she knew, and she had been by far the coolest of them all. Light, she could have planted herself. That was how upset she was. It made him feel as if the point of a knife were tickling between his shoulder blades then, and the knife was back again just thinking about her. And those dice were rattling away inside his skull. The woman's hardly likely to exchange vows here and now, he thought with a chuckle. But it sounded forced even to him. Yet there was no reason under the sun for him to be afraid. He was just properly wary, not afraid. The show might have equaled a fair-sized village for size, but there was only so long a man could wander about in that much space before he started doubling back on himself. Soon enough, too soon, he found himself staring at a windowless wagon painted in faded purple, surrounded by canvas-topped storage wagons, and inside of the southernmost horse lines. The dung carts had not gone out this morning, and the odor was strong. The wind carried a heavy scent from the nearest animal cages, too, a musky smell of big cats and bears, and the light knew what else. Beyond the storage wagons and pickets, a section of the canvas wall fell, and another began to shake as men loosened the guy ropes holding the poles. The sun, half hidden by dark clouds now, had climbed halfway to its noonday peak or better, but it was still too soon. Harnin and Metwin, two of the red arms, had already hitched the first pair of horses to the shaft of the purple wagon, and were almost done with the second pair. Soldiers well trained in the band of the Red Hand, they would be ready to take the road, while the show folk were still figuring out which way the horses were supposed to face. Matt had taught the band to move fast when there was need. His own feet dragged as though he were wading in mud. Harnin, with that fool tattoo of a hawk on his cheek, was the first to see him. Buckling a trace, the heavy-jawed file-leader exchanged looks with Metwin, a boyish-faced Kyrianan whose appearance belied his age and his weakness for tavern brawls. They had no call to look surprised. "Everything going smoothly? I want to be away in good time." Rubbing his hands together against the cold, Matt eyed the purple wagon uneasily. He should have brought her a present, jewelry or flowers. Either worked as well with most women. "Smooth enough, my lord," Harnin replied in a cautious tone. "No shouting, no screaming, no crying." He glanced at the wagon as if he did not credit it himself. "Quiet suits me," Metwin said, stringing one of the reins through a ring on a horse collar. "Woman starts crying, the only thing to do is leave if you value your hide, and we can hardly drop these off by the side of the road." But he glanced at the wagon too, and shook his head in disbelief. There really was nothing for Matt to do except go inside. So he did. It only took two tries, with a smile fixed on his face, to make himself climb the short flight of painted wood steps at the back of the wagon. He was not afraid, but any fool would know enough to be nervous. Despite the lack of windows, the interior of the wagon was well lighted, with four mirrored lamps burning, and the lamps held good oil, so there was no rancid smell. But then, with the stink from outside, it would have been hard to tell. He needed to find a better spot to park his wagon. A small brick stove with an iron door and an iron top for cooking made the space toasty compared with outside. It was not a large wagon, and every inch of wall that could be spared was covered with cabinets or shelves or pegs for hanging clothing and towels and the like. But the table that could be let down on ropes was snug against the ceiling, and the three women inside the wagon were hardly crowded. They could not have been more different, those three. Mistress Annan was sitting on one of the two narrow beds built into the walls, a regal woman with touches of gray in her hair, seemingly intent on her embroidery hoop and not looking at all as if she were a guard. A large golden ring hung in each of her ears, and her marriage knife dangled from a close-fitting silver necklace, the hilt with its red and white stones snug in the cleavage exposed by the narrow plunging neckline of her Ebudari dress that had one side of the skirt sewn up to expose yellow petticoats. She wore another knife with a long curved blade tucked behind her belt, but that was just the custom of Ebudar. Satala had refused to take on any disguise, which seemed well enough. No one had reason to be hunting for her, and finding clothes for everyone else had been a big enough problem as it was. Seleucia, a pretty woman with skin the color of buttery cream, was cross-legged on the floor between the beds, a dark scarf covering her shaven head and a sullen expression on her face, though normally she was dignified enough to make Mistress Annan look flighty. Her eyes were as blue as Aginan's and more piercing, and she had made more fuss than Aginan over losing the rest of her hair. She disliked the dark blue Ebedari dress she had been given too, claiming the deep neckline was indecent, but it hid her as effectively as a mask. Few men who glimpsed Seleucia's impressive bosom would be able to focus long on her face. He might have enjoyed the view for a moment or two himself, but there was Tuon, seated on the wagon's only stool, a leather-bound book open on her lap, and he could barely make himself look at anything else. His wife-to-be. Light. Tuon was tiny, not just short, but almost slim as a boy, and a loose-fitting dress of brown wool, bought from one of the show folk, made her seem a child wearing her older sister's clothes. Not at all the sort of woman he enjoyed, especially with only a few days' growth of black stubble covering her scalp. If you ignored that, she was pretty, though, in a reserved way, with her heart-shaped face and full lips, her eyes large dark liquid pools of serenity. That utter calmness almost unnerved him. Not even an Aes Sedai would be serene in her circumstances. The bloody dice in his head did not help matters. "Setala has been keeping me informed," she said in a cool drawl as he pulled the door shut. He had gotten so he could tell a difference in the Seanchan accents. Tuan's Meneginan sounded as if she had a mouthful of mush, but they all sounded slurred and slow.
"She's told me the story you have put about concerning me, Toy."
Tuon had persisted in calling him that, back in the Terrasen Palace. He had not cared then. Well, not much. "My name is Matt," he began. He never saw where the pottery cup in her hand came from, but he managed to drop to the floor in time for it to shatter against the door instead of his head.
"I am a servant, Toy?"
If Tuon's tone had been cool before, now it was deep winter ice. She barely raised her voice, but it was hard as ice, too. Her expression would have made a hanging judge look giddy.
"A thieving servant?"
The book slid from her lap as she stood and bent to snatch up the lidded white chamber pot.
"A faithless servant?"
"We will need that," Seleucia said deferentially, slipping the bulbous pot out of Tuon's hands. Setting it carefully to one side, she crouched at Tuon's feet, almost as if ready to hurl herself at Matt, laughable as that was, though nothing much seemed laughable right then. Mistress Annan reached up to one of the railed shelves above her head and handed Tuon another cup.
"We have plenty of these," she murmured.
Matt shot her an indignant look, but her hazel eyes twinkled with amusement. Amusement? She was supposed to be guarding those two. A fist thumped on the door.
"Do you need help in there?"
Harnan called uncertainly. Matt wondered which of them he was asking.
"We have everything well in hand,"
Satala called back, calmly pushing her needle through the fabric stretched on her hoop. He would have thought that needlework was the most important thing.
"Go on about your work. Don't dawdle."
The woman was not Ebudari, but she certainly had soaked up Ebudari ways. After a moment, boots thumped back down the steps outside. It seemed Harnan had been too long in Ebudar as well.
Tuan turned the new cup in her hands as though examining the flowers painted on it, and her lips quirked in a smile so small it almost might have been Matt's imagination. She was more than pretty when she smiled, but it was one of those smiles that said she knew things he did not. He was going to break out in hives if she kept doing that.
"I will not be known as a servant, Toy."
"My name is Matt, not that other thing," he said, climbing to his feet and cautiously testing his hip. To his surprise, it ached no worse after smacking the floorboards. Tuan arched an eyebrow and hefted the cup in one hand. "I could hardly tell the show folk I'd kidnapped the daughter of the Nine Moons," he said in exasperation.
"The High Lady Tuan, peasant,"
Seleucia said crisply.
"She is under the veil."
Veil? Tuan had worn a veil in the palace, but not since. The tiny woman gestured graciously, a queen granting license.
"It is of no import, Seleucia. He is ignorant yet. We must educate him. But you will change this story, Toy. I will not be a servant."
"It's too late to change anything," Matt said, keeping an eye on that cup. Her hands looked frail, with those long fingernails cut short, but he remembered how quick they were. "Nobody's asking you to be a servant." Luca and his wife knew the truth, but there had to be some reason to give everyone else why Tuan and Seleucia were kept confined to this wagon and guarded. The perfect solution had been a pair of serving girls about to be dismissed for theft, who had intended to betray their mistress's flight with her lover. It seemed perfect to Matt, anyway. To the show folk, it only added to the romance. He had thought Aginin was going to swallow her tongue while he was explaining to Luca. Maybe she had known how Tuan would take it. Lydie almost wished the dice would stop. How could a man think with that in his head? "I couldn't leave you behind to raise an alarm," he went on patiently. That was true, as far as it went. "I know Mistress Annan has explained it to you." He thought about saying he had been babbling from nerves when he said she was his wife. She must think him a complete looby. But it seemed best not to bring it up again. If she was willing to let the matter lie, all the better. "I know she's already told you this, but I promise no one's going to hurt you. We're not after ransom, just getting away with our heads still attached. As soon as I can figure out how to send you home safe and sound, I will. I promise. I'll make you as comfortable as I can until then. You'll just have to put up with the other." Tuan's big dark eyes crackled, heat lightning in a night sky, but she said,
"It seems I will see what your promises are worth, Toy."
At her feet, Seleucia hissed like a doused cat, her head half turning as if to object, but Tuan's left hand wiggled, and the blue-eyed woman blushed and went silent. The blood used something like maiden hand talk with their upper servants. Matt wished he understood the signals. "Answer me a question, Tuan," he said. He thought he heard Satella murmur, "Fool." Seleucia's jaw knotted, and a dangerous look kindled in Tuan's eyes, but if she was going to call him Toy, he would be burned if he gave her any titles. "How old are you?" He had heard that she was only a few years younger than he, but looking at her in that sack of a dress, it seemed impossible. To his surprise, that dangerous spark burst into flame. Not just heat lightning this time. He should have been fried on the spot. Tuan threw back her shoulders and drew herself to her full height. Such as that was, he doubted she could reach 5 feet with her heels flat, however she stretched.
"My 14th true name day will come in 5 months," she said in a voice that was far from cold.
In fact, it could have heated the wagon better than the stove. He felt a moment of hope, but she was not finished.
"No, you keep your birth names here, don't you? That will be my 20th naming day. Are you satisfied, Toy? Did you fear you had stolen a child?"
She almost hissed the last word. Matt waved his hands in front of him, frantically dismissing the suggestion. A woman started hissing at him like a kettle. A man with any brains found a way to cool her down fast. She was gripping the cup so tightly that tendons stood out on the back of her hand, and he did not want to try his hip with another fall to the floor. Come to think on it, he was not sure how hard she had tried to hit him the first time. Her hands were very fast.
"I just wanted to know, that's all," he said quickly. "I was curious, making conversation. I'm only a little older myself."
20. So much for hoping she was too young to marry for another 3 or 4 years. Anything that came between him and his wedding day would have been welcome. Tuan studied him suspiciously with her head tilted,
then tossed the cup onto the bed beside Mistress Annan, and seated herself on the stool again, taking as much care about arranging her voluminous woolen skirts as if they had belonged to a silk gown. But she continued to examine him through her long eyelashes.
"Where is your ring?"
she demanded. Unconsciously, he thumbed the finger on his left hand where the long ring usually lay. "I don't wear it all the time." Not when everybody in the Terrasen Palace knew he wore it. The thing would have stood out with his rough layabout's garb in any case. It was not even his signet, anyway, just a carver's tri-piece. Strange how his hand felt noticeably lighter without it. Too light. Strange that she remarked on it, too. But then, why not? Light those dice had him shying at shadows and jumping at sighs. Or maybe it was just her, a discomforting thought. He moved to sit on the unoccupied bed, but Seleucia swung herself up onto it so quickly any of the acrobats might have been jealous, and stretched out with her head propped on her hand. That pushed her scarf askew for a moment, but she hurriedly straightened it, all the while staring at him, proud and cold as a queen. He looked at the other bed, and Mistress Annan set down her embroidery long enough to ostentatiously smooth her skirts, making it clear she did not intend to share an inch. Burn her, she was behaving as though she were guarding Tuan from him. Women always seemed to club together, so a man never had a fair chance. Well, he had managed to keep Aginan from taking charge so far, and he was not about to be bullied by Sitala Annan, or a bosomy lady's maid, or the high and mighty High Lady Daughter of the Nine Bloody Moons. Only, he could hardly go shoving one of them out of the way to find a place to sit. Leaning against a drawered cabinet at the foot of the bed Mistress Annan was seated on, he tried to think of what to say. He never had trouble thinking of what to say to women, but his brain seemed deafened by the sound of those dice. All three women gave him disapproving looks. He could all but hear one of them telling him not to slouch. So he smiled. Most women thought his best smile very winning. Tuan let out a long breath that did not sound won over in the slightest.
"Do you remember Hawkwing's face, Toy?"
Mistress Annan blinked in surprise, and Seleucia sat up on the bed frowning. At him. Why would she frown at him? Tuan just continued to look at him, hands folded in her lap, as cool and collected as a wisdom at Sunday. Matt's smile felt frozen. Light, what did she know? How could she know anything? He lay beneath the burning sun, holding his side with both hands, trying to keep the last of life from leaking out and wondering whether there was any reason to hold on. Aldishar was finished after this day's work. A shadow blotted the sun for an instant, and then a tall man in armor crouched beside him, helmet tucked under his arm, dark, deep-set eyes framing a hooked nose.
"You fought well against me today, Culain, and many days past," that memorable voice said. "Will you live with me in peace?"
With his last breath, he laughed in Arthur Hawkwing's face. He hated to remember dying. A dozen other encounters skittered through his mind, too. Ancient memories that were his now. Arta Pendrag had been a difficult man to get along with even before the wars started. Drawing a deep breath, he took care choosing his words. This was no time to go spouting the old tongue.
"Of course I don't," he lied.
A man who could not lie convincingly got short shrift from women.
"Light, Hawkwing died 1,000 years ago. What kind of question is that?"
Her mouth opened slowly, and for a moment he was sure she meant to answer question with question.
"A foolish one, Toy," she replied finally instead. "I can't say why it popped into my head."
The stiffness in Matt's shoulders relaxed a little.
Of course, he was Tavirin.
People did things and said things around him they never would elsewhere. Nonsense qualified. Still, a thing like that could become uncomfortable when it hit too close to home.
"My name is Matt. Matt Cawthon."
He might as well not have spoken.
"I cannot say what I will do after returning to Abu Dhar, Toy. I have not decided. I may have you made Dakovale. You are not pretty enough for a cupbearer, but it might please me to have you for one. Still, you have represented certain promises to me, so it pleases me now to promise as well. So long as you keep your promises, I will neither escape nor betray you in any way, nor will I cause dissension among your followers. I believe that covers everything necessary."
This time Mistress Annan gaped at her, and Seleucia made a sound in her throat, but Tuan appeared not to notice either woman. She just looked at him expectantly, waiting on a response. He made a sound in his throat, too. Not a whimper, just a sound. Tuan's face was as smooth as a stern mask of dark glass. Her calm was madness, but this made gibbering look sane. She would have to be insane to think he would believe that offer. Except he thought she did mean it. That, or she was a better liar than he ever hoped to be. Again he had that queasy sense that she knew more than he did. Ridiculous, of course, but there it was. He swallowed a lump in his throat. A hard lump. "Well, that does all right for you," he said, trying to buy time. "But what about Seleucia?" Time for what? He could not think with those dice pounding in his skull.
"Seleucia follows my wishes, Toy," she said impatiently.
The blue-eyed woman herself straightened and stared at him as though indignant that he had doubted that. For a lady's maid, she could look fierce when she tried. Matt did not know what to say or do. Without thinking, he spat on his palm and offered his hand as if sealing a bargain on a horse.
"Your customs are earthy," Tuan said in a dry voice, but she spat on her own palm and clasped his hand. "Thus is our treaty written. Thus is our agreement made. What does that writing on your spear mean, Toy?"
He did whimper this time, and not because she had read the old tongue inscription on his Ashendarai. A bloody stone would have whimpered. The dice had stopped as soon as he touched her hand. Light, what had happened? Knuckles rapped on the door, and he was so on edge that he moved without thought, spinning, a knife coming into either hand ready to throw at whatever came in. "Stay behind me," he snapped. The door opened, and Tom stuck his head in. The hood of his cloak was up, and Matt realized it was raining outside. Between Tuan and the dice, he had missed the sound of rain hitting the wagon's roof.
"I trust I'm not interrupting anything," Tom said, knuckling his long white mustaches.
Matt's face heated. Satala had frozen with her embroidery needle, trailing blue thread down to her work, and her eyebrows seemed to be trying to climb over the top of her head. Tensed on the edge of the other bed, Seleucia watched him slip the knives back up his sleeves with considerable interest. He would not have thought she was the sort to like dangerous men. That kind of woman was worth avoiding. They tended to find ways to make a man need to be dangerous. He did not glance back at Tuan. She was probably staring at him as if he had been capering like Luca. Just because he did not want to get married did not mean he wanted his future wife to think him a fool. "What did you find out, Tom?" he asked brusquely. Something had happened, or the dice would not have stopped. A thought came that made his hair want to stand on end. This was the second time they had stopped in Tuan's presence. The third, counting the gate leading out of Abu Dhar. 3 bloody times and all tied to her. Limping slightly, the white-haired man came the rest of the way in, pushing back his hood, and pulled the door shut behind him. His limp came from an old injury, not trouble in the city. Tall and lean and leathery, with sharp blue eyes and snowy mustaches that hung below his chin, it seemed he would draw attention wherever he went. But he had practice at hiding in plain sight, and his dark bronze coat and brown wool cloak were suitable for a man with a little coin to spend, but not too much.
"The streets are full of rumors about her," he said, nodding toward Tuan, "but nothing about her disappearing. I bought drinks for a few Shanchan officers, and they seem to believe she's snug in the terrace in palace, or off on an inspection trip. I didn't sense any dissembling, Matt. They didn't know."
"Did you expect public announcements, Toy?" Tuan said incredulously. "As it is, Suroth may be considering taking her own life for the shame. Do you expect her to spread such an ill omen for the return about for everyone to see on top of that?"
So Aginan had been right. It still seemed impossible. And it did not seem at all important compared to the dice stopping. What had happened? He had shaken hands with Tuan, that was all. Shaken hands and made a bargain. He meant to keep his side, but what had the dice told him? That she would keep hers, or that she would not? For all he knew, Shanchan noblewomen were in the habit of marrying, what was it she had said she was going to make him? A cupbearer? Maybe they married cupbearers all the time.
"There's more, Matt," Tom said,
eyeing Tuan thoughtfully and with a hint of surprise. It came to Matt that she did not appear overly concerned that Suroth might kill herself. Maybe she was as tough as Doman thought. What were the bloody dice trying to tell him? That was what was important. Then Tom went on, and Matt forgot about how tough Tuan might be, and even the dice.
Thailand's dead. They're keeping it quiet for fear of disturbances, but one of the palace guards, a young lieutenant who couldn't hold his brandy, told me they're planning her funeral feast and Beslan's coronation for the same day.
How? Matt demanded. She was older than he, but not that much older. Beslan's coronation. Light. How would Beslan cope with that, when he hated the Seanchan? It had been his plan to fire those supplies in the Bay Road. He would have tried an uprising if Matt had not convinced him it would only result in a slaughter, and not of Seanchan. Tom hesitated, stroking his mustaches with a thumb. Finally he sighed.
She was found in her bedchamber the morning after we left, Matt. Still bound, hand and foot. Her head had been torn off.
Matt did not realize his knees had given way until he found himself sitting on the floor with his head buzzing. He could hear her voice.
You'll get your head cut off if you're not careful, Piglet, and I wouldn't like that.
Setala leaned forward on the narrow bed to press a hand against his cheek in commiseration.
The Windfinders, he said hollowly.
He did not have to say more.
According to what that lieutenant said, the Seanchan have settled on Aes Sedai for the blame, because Thailand had sworn the Seanchan oaths. That's what they'll announce at her funeral feast.
Thailand dies the same night the Windfinders escape, and the Seanchan believe Aes Sedai killed her?
He could not imagine Thailand dead.
I'm going to have you for supper, duckling.
That doesn't make sense, Tom. Tom hesitated, frowning as he considered.
It could be political in part, but I think that's what they really believe, Matt. That lieutenant said they're sure the Windfinders were running too hard to stop or go out of their way, and the quickest path out of the palace from the Damani kennels goes nowhere near Tarin's apartments.
Matt grunted. He was sure it was not so. And if it were, there was nothing in the world he could do about it.
The Marath Damani had reason to murder Thailand, Seleucia said suddenly. They must fear her example for others. What reason had the Damani you speak of? None. The hand of justice requires motive and proof, even for Damani and Dacovale.
She sounded as though she were reading the words off a page, and she was looking at Tuan from the corner of her eye. Matt looked over his shoulder, but if the tiny woman had been using her hands to tell Seleucia what to say, they were resting in her lap, now. She was watching him, a neutral expression on her face.
Did you care for Thailand so deeply? She said in a cautious voice.
Yes. No. Burn me, I liked her.
Turning away, he scrubbed fingers through his hair, pushing the cap off. He had never been so glad to get away from a woman in his life. But this.
And I left her tied up and gagged so she couldn't even call for help. Easy prey for the golem, he said bitterly. It was looking for me. Don't shake your head, Tom. You know it as well as I do.
What is a golem? Tuan asked.
Shadow spawn, m'lady, Tom said.
He frowned worriedly. He did not take easily to worry, but anybody except a fool would worry about a golem.
It looks like a man, but it can slip through a mouse hole or under a door, and it's strong enough to...
He harrumphed through his mustaches.
Well, enough of that. Matt, she could have had 100 guards around her, and it wouldn't have stopped that thing.
She would not have needed 100 guards if she had not taken up with Matt Cawthon.
A golem, Tuan murmured wryly.
Suddenly, she rapped Matt hard on the top of his head with her knuckles. Clapping a hand to his scalp, he stared over his shoulder incredulously.
I'm very happy that you show loyalty to Thailand, Toy, she said in a severe voice. But I won't have superstition in you. I will not have it. It does Thailand no honor.
Burn him, Thailand's death seemed to concern her as little as whether or not Suroth committed suicide. What kind of a woman was he going to marry? When a fist pounded on the door this time, he did not even bother to stand. He felt numb at the core and scraped raw on the surface. Blaric pushed into the wagon without asking, his dark brown cloak dripping rain. It was an old cloak, worn thin in spots, but he appeared not to care where the rain leaked through. The warder ignored everyone but Matt. Or almost everyone. The man actually took a moment to consider Seleucia's bosom.
"Jolene wants you, Cawthon,"
he said, still studying her.
Light. This was all Matt needed to make it a fine day.
"Who is Jolene?"
Tuan demanded. Matt ignored her.
"Tell Jolene I'll see her once we're on the road, Blerick."
The last thing he wanted was to be forced to listen to more of the Aes Sedai's grievances now.
"She wants you now, Cawthon."
With a sigh, Matt got to his feet and gathered his cap from the floor. Blerick looked as if he might try to drag him otherwise. In his own current mood, he thought he might put a knife in the man if he tried, and get his neck broken for his pains. A warder would not take a knife in the ribs lightly. He was fairly sure he had already died the one time he was allowed, and not in an old memory. Sure enough, not to take risks, he could sidestep.
"Who is Jolene, Toy?"
If he had not known better, he would have said Tuan sounded jealous.
"A bloody Aes Sedai," he grumbled, tugging the cap on, and got one small pleasure for the day.
Tuan's jaw dropped in shock. He shut the door behind him on the way out before she could find a word to say. A very small pleasure. One butterfly on a midden heap. Tylan dead and the Windfinders might take the blame yet, whatever Tom said. And that was aside from Tuan and the bloody dice. A very tiny butterfly and a very large midden. The sky was full of dark clouds now, and the downpour steady. A soaking rain, they would have called it, back home. It began to slick his hair, cap or no, and seep through his coat as soon as he stepped outside. Blerick hardly seemed to notice, barely gathering his cloak. There was nothing for it but for Matt to hunch his shoulders and splash through the widening puddles on the dirt streets. By the time he could reach his wagon for a cloak, he would be drenched to the skin anyway. Besides, the weather fit his spirits. To his surprise, rain or no rain, an incredible amount of work had been done in the short time he was inside. The canvas wall was gone as far as he could see in either direction, and half the storage wagons that had been around Tuan's wagon were missing too. So were most of the animals that had been picketed on the horse lines. A large, iron-barred cage containing a black-maned lion trundled past toward the road behind a plotting team, the horses as unconcerned about the apparently sleeping lion behind them as they were with the shower. Performers were already taking to the road, too, though how they determined the order of leaving was a mystery. Most of the tents seemed to have vanished. In one place, three of the brightly colored wagons together might be missing, another place every second wagon, while elsewhere, the wagons standing and waiting still seemed a solid mass. The only thing that said the show folk were not scattering was Luca himself, a bright red cloak gathered around him against the wet as he paraded along the street, stopping now and then to clap a man on the shoulder or murmur something to a woman that made her laugh. If the show had been breaking apart, Luca would have been out chasing down those who tried to leave. He held the show together as much by persuasion as anything else, and he never let anyone leave without talking himself hoarse, trying to argue them out of it. Matt knew he should feel good about seeing Luca still there, though it had never occurred to him that the man would run out on the gold, but right at that moment he doubted that anything could make him feel anything but numb and angry. The wagon that Blerick took him to was almost as large as Luca's, but it had been whitewashed rather than painted. The white had long since run and streaked and faded, and the rain was washing it a little more toward gray, where the wood was not already bare. The wagon belonged to a company of fools, four morose men who painted their faces for the show's patrons, dousing each other with water and hitting each other with inflated pig bladders, and otherwise spent their time and money imbibing as much wine as they could buy. With what Matt had paid for rent, they might be drunk for months, and it had cost more than that to make anyone take them in. Four shaggy, nondescript horses were already hitched to the wagon, and Fen Mizar, Jolene's other warder, was up on the driver's seat, swathed in an old gray cloak, and reins in hand. His tilted eyes watched Matt the way a wolf might watch an impudent cur. The warders had been unhappy with Matt's plan from the start. Sure, they could have gotten the sisters away safely once they were outside the city walls. Perhaps they could have, but the Seanchan hunted vigorously for women who could channel. The show itself apparently had been searched four times in the days after Ebudar fell, and all it would have taken was one slip to land all of them in the stew pot. From what Aginan and Doman said, the Seekers could make a boulder tell everything it had ever seen. Luckily, not all the sisters were as sure as Jolene's warders. Aes Sedai tended to dither when they could not agree on what to do. When Matt reached the steps at the back of the wagon,
Blerick stopped him with a hand to his chest. The warder's face might have been carved, no more concerned than a piece of wood with the rain running down his cheeks.
Fenn and I are grateful to you for getting her out of the city, Cawthon. But this can't continue. The sisters are crowded, sharing with those other women, and they don't get on. There's going to be trouble if we can't find another wagon.
Is that what this is about? Matt said crossly, tugging his collar tighter. Not that it did much good. He was already wet through on the back, and not much better in front. If Jolene had pulled him here to whine about the accommodations again...
She'll tell you what it's about, Cawthon. Just remember what I said.
Grumbling under his breath, Matt climbed the dirt-streaked steps and went in, not quite slamming the door behind him. The wagon was laid out much like the one Tuon was in, though with four beds, two of them folded flat against the walls above the other two. He had no idea how the six women arranged sleeping, but he suspected it was not done peacefully. The air in the wagon all but crackled like grease on a griddle. Three women sat on each of the lower beds, each variously watching or ignoring the women seated on the other bed. Jolene, who had never been held as Damani, behaved as though the three Suldam did not exist. Reading a small wood-bound book, she was an Aes Sedai to the inch in arrogance on a stick, despite her well-worn blue dress, lately owned by a woman who taught the lions to do tricks. The other two sisters knew firsthand what it was to be Damani, though. Edesina watched the three Suldam warily, one hand resting near her belt knife, while Teslin's eyes shifted constantly, looking at anything except the Suldam, and her hands kneaded her dark woolen skirts. He did not know how Aginan had coerced the three Suldam into helping Damani escape, but even though they were being sought by the authorities as surely as Aginan, they had not changed their attitudes toward women who could channel. Bethamin, tall and as dark as Tuon, in an Ebudari dress, with a very deep neckline and skirts sewn up above her knee on one side to show faded red petticoats, seemed a mother waiting for inevitable misbehavior by children, while yellow-haired Sita, in high-necked gray wool that covered her completely, appeared to be studying dangerous dogs that would need to be caged sooner or later. Renna, she of the talk about cutting off hands and feet, pretended to be reading too, but every so often her deceptively mild brown eyes rose from the slim volume to study the Aes Sedai, and when they did, she smiled in an unpleasant way. Matt felt like cursing before one of them opened her mouth. A wise man kept clear when women were at odds, especially if there were Aes Sedai among them, but this was how it always was when he came to this wagon. "This better be important, Jolene." Unbuttoning his coat, he tried to shake some of the water off. He thought he would do better wringing the garment out. "I just learned that the Golem killed Tylin the night we left, and I'm in no mood for complaints." Jolene marked her place carefully with an embroidered marker and folded her hands in the book before speaking. Aes Sedai never hurried. They just expected everyone else to. Without him, she likely would have been wearing an Idam by now herself. But he had never found Aes Sedai particularly noted for gratitude, either. She ignored what he had said about Tylin.
"Blerick tells me the show has already begun moving," she said coolly. "But you must stop it. Luca will only listen to you."
Her mouth tightened slightly on the words. Aes Sedai also were unused to not being listened to, and greens were not the best at hiding their displeasure.
"We must abandon the idea of Lugard for the time being. We must take the ferry across the harbor and go to Ilion."
That was about as bad a suggestion as he had heard out of her, though she did not mean it for a suggestion, of course. She was worse than Aginan that way. With half the show already on the road, or near enough, it would take all day just to get everyone down to the ferry landing, and it would mean going into the city besides. Heading for Lugard took the show away from the Seanchan as quickly as possible, while they had soldiers camped all the way to the Ilion border and maybe beyond. Aginan was reluctant to tell what she knew, but Tom had his ways of learning these things. Matt did not bother to crack his teeth, though. He did not need to.
"No,"
Teslin said in a tight voice, her Ilioner accent strong. Leaning past Edesina, she looked as though she chewed rocks three meals a day, hard-faced and set-jawed, but there was a nervousness in her eyes, put there by her weeks as a Damani.
"No, Jolene. I have told you. We do not dare risk it. We do not dare."
"Light," Jolene spat, slamming her book to the floor.
"Take hold of yourself, Teslin. Just because you were held prisoner for a little time is no reason to go to pieces. Go to pieces. Go to pieces. Let them put that collar on you, and then speak of going to pieces."
Teslin's hand went to her throat, as though she felt the Idam's collar still.
Help me convince her, Edesina. She will have us collared again if we do let her.
Edesina drew back on herself against the wall behind the bed. A slim, handsome woman, with black hair spilling to her waist, she always went silent when the red and the green argued, as they did often. But Jolene did not spare her so much as a glance.
You ask a rebel for help, Teslin? We should have left her for the Seanchan. Listen to me. You can feel it as well as I. Would you really accept a greater danger to avoid a lesser? Lesser, Teslin snarled. You do know nothing of—
Renna held her book out at arm's length and let it drop to the floor with a bang.
If my lord will excuse us a little while, we still have our eye dumb, and we can teach these girls to behave again in short order.
Her accent had a musical quality, but the smile on her lips never touched her brown eyes.
It never works to let them go slack this way.
Sita nodded grimly and stood as if to fetch out the leashes.
I think we're done with Idom, Bethamin said, ignoring the shocked looks from the other two Suldam. But there are other ways to settle these girls down. May I suggest my lord return in an hour? They'll tell you what you want to know without any squabbling once they can't sit down.
She sounded as though she meant exactly what she said. Jolene was staring at the three Suldam in outraged disbelief, but Edesina was sitting up straight, gripping her belt knife with a determined expression, while Teslin was now the one shrinking back against the wall, her hands clasped tightly at her waist.
That won't be necessary, Matt said after a moment. Only a moment.
However satisfying it might be to have Jolene settled down, Edesina might draw that knife, and that would set the cat among the chickens no matter how it turned out.
What greater danger are you talking about, Jolene? Jolene? What danger is greater than the Seanchan right now?
The green decided her stare was making no impression on Bethamin, and turned it on Matt instead. Had she been other than Aes Sedai, he would have said she looked sulky. Jolene disliked explaining.
If you must know, someone is channeling.
Teslin and Edesina nodded, the red sister reluctantly, the yellow emphatically.
In the camp, he said in alarm.
His right hand rose on its own to press against the silver fox head under his shirt, but the medallion had not turned cold.
Far away,
Jolene replied, still unwilling.
To the north. Much farther than any of us should be able to sense channeling,
Edesina put in, a touch of fear in her voice.
The amount of Sayadar being wielded must be immense. Inconceivable.
She fell silent at a sharp glance from Jolene, who turned back to study Matt as though deciding how much she had to tell him.
At that distance, she went on, we wouldn't be able to feel every sister in the tower channeling. It has to be the Forsaken, and whatever they're doing, we do not want to be any closer than we can avoid.
Matt was still for a moment. Then finally he said,
if it's far, then we stick with the plan.
Jolene went on arguing, but he did not bother to listen. Whenever he thought of Rand or Perrin, colors swirled in his head. A part of being Tavirin, he supposed. This time he had not thought of either of his friends, but the colors had suddenly been there, a fan of a thousand rainbows. This time they had almost formed an image, a vague impression that might have been a man and a woman, seated on the ground facing one another. It was gone in an instant, but he knew as surely as he knew his name. Not the Forsaken. Rand. And he could not help wondering what Rand had been doing when the dice stopped.